The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
HD Smartcast.
You're listening to a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
You're listening to On the Record with me, Sunetra Chaudhary, and I'm super excited about my guest today. Economist Geeta Gopinath has just been appointed the first Deputy Managing Director at the International Monetary Fund. It's the first time that a woman has got this job. It's especially exciting knowing that she studied in Delhi, in Lady Sriram College, and later at Delhi School of Economics before moving to Princeton. And now she's on a break from teaching at Harvard University. So what does one of the world's top economists think about the state of the world now? About the position of women in it. Here's Geeta Gopinath and surviving the post-pandemic world. So congratulations on the new assignment. I just wanted to ask you what you made of all these headlines that I saw so many people have said that IMF is now led by two women.
Oh, but thank you. I think it's great and fantastic. And, I had a great time working with the managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, and we work really well together. So, let's see what comes out of it.
I wanted to ask you, is there any particular, because, we all heard you make the announcement that you're going back to your teaching job at Harvard. And then this came up. Was there anything that kind of made up your mind about why you should at this moment, stay back at the fund instead of going to an academic life?
So I was presented with this new opportunity, which is becoming the first deputy managing director. And, in my 3 years at the fund, I could see the impact that we had when we combined very rigorous analytical work and public policy making. The hope was that maybe the crisis was coming off, and this was okay for me to go back to academia. Yeah. But unfortunately, the recent months have shown that this is not over, and there's still a lot of uncertainty for the future. These are turbulent times. There are big economic issues the world is grappling with. So I thought, okay, maybe it probably makes sense for me to continue in public service for a few more years.
I mean, I find it amazing that it's the first woman doing the job that you're doing. Why do you think that is?
As chief economist,
yes,
right?
Yes,
yes. No, I think, it's just a reflection of the fact that for the longest time, society hasn't done what was needed to make sure that women got the opportunities they absolutely deserve. It's not like women were not ready for these jobs. They've always been ready for these jobs. It's just that, they didn't come to mind because you always had male chief economists, and they tend to think of other men. So you have to break the mold. You have to break the trends. I'm glad that did change with me, though there were lots of other women economists before me who could have done the job well. So,
is it especially true in your field of economics? And I ask you that because recently I heard this interview of Cecilia Conrad, mm-hmm. and she was talking about the fact that, she, like yourself, is a woman of color. And she was talking about the fact that when she first started at Duke University, her HOD, head of the department, had to come and tell her that, put on really complex stuff on the blackboard so that a lot of men, white men who are listening to you, your students, they don't undermine you. You're such a good teacher. You're making it look easy. So you have to. And she then went on to say that at every meeting later on in life, I had to give a version of that complex calculus on the board to prove myself. And then it would be okay because usually people just assume. And she said, especially true of economics. I just wanted to know from your experience, do you share that? And can you, like, you know, share some experience like that?
I completely understand where she's coming from. And even within economics, some fields of economics have a much bigger male dominance than others do. So macroeconomics, for instance, is the area that I work in, where you had, you know, if you think of all the famous economists, I mean, they're all men, you know, Keynes and Friedman and you know, Adam Smith and so on. They're all male names. And so it's absolutely the case that this, I think as a woman, you are being constantly judged about how good you are and whether you know your stuff. And you do have to work extra hard at being always extremely prepared, you know, having the right answers. You know, earlier in my career, there were times when you felt people were speaking over you, mm-hmm. you know, that they just didn't really want to listen to what you had to say. But of course, that changes over time, thankfully.
Is there a hack that you have that you can share? Like she said that basically with every meeting, I had to do a version of it. Do you have a hack? Because I think it's extremely useful, you know, for all women to kind of gain from that. And you've been so successful. So is there a hack that you have?
You know, I think I don't suffer disrespect lightly in any form or shape. So I think my style has been more about, you know, just demanding that people listen to what I have to say when I have something to say. And you have to be there. You think you have to be your best advocate at all times. And, you know, have faith in your own abilities, because most people will not pat you on the back. So you have to be, in some sense, your own biggest advocate and have faith in what you can do and, you know, push yourself forward.
How is your academic life or life on campus at Harvard different from your job at the IMF?
You know, this, what we're doing right now is much more common in my current job at the IMF than as a Harvard professor.
Journalists always reach out to all Harvard academics, especially in your field, right? They're giving economists, you know, academics are always...
No, they do, but not with the frequency that you would once you're in the public space. When you are, you know, have a public profile, then there's a lot more of that happens. You know, as an academic, I used to love having long hours, very quiet hours of, you know, sitting with my books, which I unfortunately don't have at this time. But on the other hand, you know, this has been, it's been great to be able to have much more immediate visible impact on the world, which is much harder to do as a professor.
You know, as chief economist, was there something that you feel that you kind of influenced? Like you're saying that, you know, there's greater satisfaction that way. And yep. Especially, so, you talk a lot about public service as well. Yeah.
The... you know, I co-authored a paper on a proposal to end the COVID-19 pandemic,
yes.
Where I think it was one of the first that provided some sort of a roadmap on what was needed on vaccinations, testing, therapeutics, in terms of making sure there was equitable access around the world. We were building off the very important work that had been done by the WHO and the World Bank, but kind of we put a proposal together, we put a price tag on it, which is $50 billion. You know, we had done previous analysis that showed that the gains were in trillions of dollars to having these kinds of policies in place. So it was a very clear, obvious investment case. And, you know, that has been helpful. With the Multilateral Leaders Task Force came out of that, which was a joint, you know, collaboration between the WHO, the World Bank, WTO, and the IMF. You know, they were endorsed the principles of that proposal. And we've been working very hard to, you know, get action on the ground. So, you know, that's, I guess, one example of where I feel like I was in a position to have direct influence.
No, and I have lots of follow-up questions about the COVID situation, but I want to just stay with this, you know, about your development and your education and all of that, because you have so much of an India connection in that as well. Just you know, I see when I look at your bio and you having studied in Mysore and then Lady Shri Ram College in Delhi and Delhi School of Economics, what do you think contributed most? Because I know I heard your previous interview where you said that the first time you read about economics was when you came to a university as an undergraduate. So what do you think contributed most to you becoming like a top person in your field in economics?
So I took my first class in economics at LSR. That was the year 1989 to 92 is when I did my undergrad. And if you remember, those were the years when India had an external account crisis. Yeah. You know, it had an IMF program. It went on the path of liberalization and opening up. Economics became very tangible, very interesting. And so that was one big event that triggered my deeper interest in the subject. In general, I've always, I was a science student before. I love the use of mathematical tools in economics. So that was fun. So it's a social science, which uses a lot of mathematics. And so I enjoyed that too. So I think it's those combination where it's very clear that economics is a subject which has a lot of social relevance. Doing economics right in the policy space can make a big difference to people's lives. And it was intellectually very interesting too. So,
was it enabling your early education? Because, you know, there's so much talk right now about which runs down Indian education. So many people who can afford it, they send their children to IB schools or, GCSEs and international boards so that they get an international level of education. I want to ask you, because you're really, till your master's, your graduate program, it's all an Indian education.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you, how would you assess it? Or is it just that you were brilliant and you would have done really well anywhere? Because that's of interest to all of us, you know?
Obviously times have changed and the kinds of options people have these days is different from back then. But it remains the case that while there are some very good colleges with very good faculty in economics, it's still limited in numbers. Mm-hmm. And, it's still pretty shocking the cutoffs that I read about to get into LSR. I would never get in this time.
You follow that?
Yeah, it's hard not to follow. It's just, it's insane, 99.9% and so on. So obviously there is a shortage, there's a supply problem in terms of, good institutions at which people can get a strong education in fields like economics. I think in other subjects, maybe in the sciences, there's much more there. And so that's why I think people are looking outside. Also, the whole liberal arts education where you don't have to commit to a subject at the age of 17 or 18, which is a big thing, right? I mean, it turned out for me, it turned out fine that I started doing economics and something that I stuck with and I actually enjoyed it. But it could have just been as well as been that I hated it, right? So the fact that you have to commit to what degree you're going to get in is a huge commitment. And so I think for a lot of people, the attraction of what some of these overseas universities is that you have the ability to delay that decision when you've taken a few more classes to see what you want to do. But of course, there are other colleges coming up in the US, sorry, in India now, right? Which have more of a liberal arts perspective.
But otherwise, by itself, because you teach at an Ivy League now, would you say that LSR, and I know, don't worry about the fact that, your old college will get hurt or anything. You can be honest about that. Do you think LSR or Delhi School of Economics, are they world standard?
I mean, they're very, very good institutions. There are differences in the extent that, for instance, when I teach at, when I was teaching at Harvard, and I would decide the topics I would cover, right? Based on all the advances that had been made in the previous year. My syllabus changed every year. But here, of course, the syllabus is set at a much more, at a higher institutional level. There is a very particular set of topics that get covered. So I think that's different. So that's one of the differences, is that, you know, there's a, there the professors have much more flexibility on their course material, course content, and so on. Then, of course, there is a difference in terms of being more research universities, where the faculty does a lot of hardcore research. But, you know, again, I'm very proud of my background in terms of LSR and Delhi School of Economics and the opportunities both those universities gave me. And, you know, we must remember that these were all very affordable universities to study, right? I mean, it's incredible that...
Almost free.
Yeah, that is... it's pretty amazing too.
Do you think that, apart from that, do you also think that there's this moment in time right now that women of color, you know, I know that, you know, people would say, oh, Indian people of Indian origin are in great places in companies, they're CEOs and all that. But I also think, you know, I mean, if you look at it, Kamala Harris is American, But do you think there's a moment there? Because Lina Nair's announcement came out just yesterday, or day before she's announced, and, you know, your appointment. And we are, or is it, are we just reading too much into it? Or we're looking for that little spark of hope and all of this. What do you make of that?
I don't know if this is the moment. I'm one of those people that if I have to say that, I'm going to have to look at data and trends and to see whether there's something different now relative to, you know, in the past. So I don't know. But you know, it is certainly, you know, it's you know, I'm certainly reading. I don't know if it's because I'm paying more attention to the news, but you certainly do hear about people of Indian origin in senior positions.
But this you would know about. Why is it that the Indian women workforce is so low? You know,
women's labor force participation, it's not only that it's low, but it's declined.
Yes.
Over time, and that is deeply troubling. So I don't work in this area, so I haven't, you know, personally researched it. But from what I have read, it's a combination of factors. One of it is the fact that, you know, for women, it continues to be the case that they have to both be the caregivers at home, take care of the family while doing the job too. Which means that if it so happens that, you know, incomes go up in the house, that it's so exhausting to be doing everything that a woman might decide to stay home. Unfortunately, that kind of effect is showing up at lower levels of income in India than you saw in other countries, right? Usually income, per capita income goes up much more before you see this effect. Which then tells you that, you know, women need more support at home to be able to also engage in work outside. Secondly, it also matters what the office environment is like, you know, whether there is a clear recognition of the management of companies, you know, clearly says that they need to have more women in senior positions, give women the right opportunities, create the right work environment for women. That's important. It's important to have the, you know, for women to feel safe to travel around, to go to work, at different hours. Is not guaranteed, unfortunately. So there's that too. And of course, there is the fact that, you know, it remains the case that women have lesser access to education, even now in many parts of India, than men, boys do. So, I mean, all of these need to be addressed. Education levels are going up, but it's true. It is disappointing that women's participation has not gone up.
I read this interview of your mother where she said that, you know, that you're very lucky as well, that you have a good partner who you come back to a nice background too. And I found it in great contrast to Indra Nooyi's mother, what she had said, right? That, you know, you still need to go out there and get milk. And she, of course, said that her mother had evolved from there. We interviewed her recently when a book came out. But I just wanted to ask you, do you think that's important, having the right kind of partner that you choose?
Absolutely.
In what way?
If you plan to have a partner, it's very important.
Yeah, sure.
It's very important to have a supportive partner who cares about all the things that you accomplish too, and not just their own accomplishments. So I've been extremely lucky on that front. I'm married to a person who has been, you know, a huge support, and you know, also one of the people I rely on advice on all issues related to my career too. And, you know, I think that's very important, because you can't do a job well if you're not mentally happy too. And so, having the right.
So if we kind of extend that, do you think that the reason why Indian women are so doing so poorly in the workforce and there's such less, you know, participation is the fact that Indian men have a lot to do when it comes to supporting, you know, their partners in pursuing their work? Is that a fair assessment and a conclusion to draw from that?
I think it is important for Indian men to do a whole lot more to support women. You know, there are, I do see changing trends among, you know, friends that I have in, you know, here, but obviously that's not all of India. And there are some very, it still remains, there are stereotypes on what women do versus what men do. And that can only change when men, you know, become hugely supportive of their spouses.
Okay, if we come now more to the COVID situation, and you know, as you said, that you've done lots of work in that area as well. I wanted to ask you, what do you think about how India has done? And what do you think that we need to do much more in the post-COVID scenario?
India rolled out policies very quickly to address the aftermath, the consequences of the pandemic, be it in terms of you know, fiscal measures. There were, you know, cash transfers to some poor households, the grains, providing food grains, but also in terms of helping with loans and credit, and you know, so lots of measures were rolled out. In terms of vaccinations, India has been is one of the destinations for vaccines, and that has helped India a lot in terms of getting vaccinations in arm. In terms of what needs to be done, I think first and foremost, the push on vaccinations has to continue. I was looking at the numbers. So in terms of first dose vaccinations as a share of the total population, it's close to 60% now. But fully vaccinated is 37% in terms of as a share of the population, not just the adult population. Usually what happens is that when cases come down, people think, well, this is over, and then they stop pushing on that front. And I think that you really need to continue that, right? Now, even though we know in other parts of the world, like the UK, which have high levels of vaccination rates, cases are going up. But, you know, you want to protect against severe disease and hospitalization and death. And that vaccines still provide that protection. So that, I think, has to remain a huge priority. We do think that, you know, so there has been a recovery in the Indian economy, of course. It's back to pre-pandemic levels. But it's been 2 years cumulatively where there hasn't been growth over 2 years, right? And so, there is still what we could describe it as a partial recovery. It's an uneven recovery, which is that if you look at rural areas, if you look at especially, you know, low-skilled workers, informal workers, the hit to their livelihoods have been much more. If you look at employment numbers, again, they have not returned to pre-pandemic levels. You can see that when you look at the amount of uptake of the Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme. You know, that's still, there's a huge demand for it. If you look at enterprises, the larger firms are doing well, but if you look at small enterprises, they're mid-sized enterprises, they're not doing as well.
Mm.
So there are these very divergent recoveries that the policies would be needed to address. And attention has to be paid to it. On a more longer term basis, there's been, of course, lots of reforms that have been pushed through, including the privatization of Air India, which, you know, I think is a very welcome reform that happened. But, you know, India would need to maintain higher levels of spending on health, on education, It will need to continue to spend a lot, and it has been doing a lot in physical infrastructure, digital infrastructure. It will need to do that. So, you know, those kinds of priorities will have to still be there.
So you said cash transfer is a very important component of that. We only saw some state governments, for example, where you're advising Kerala, they did cash transfers. The centers kind of, you know, held back on that. They've done more the food transfer, grain transfer.
And the rural employment.
And the rural employment one.
Sure.
So would you still say that at this moment, would you recommend direct cash transfers?
Right. So firstly, I'm not advising the Kerala government right now. That was in, I forget when. I'm not doing that anymore. So our view was that, more support needed to be provided, but in the supplemental budgets, the supplementary budgets that were passed, where they allocated more money for food grains, and they allocated more money for, again, MNREGA, the employment guarantee scheme. I think those pretty much are what would be consistent with what we're saying in terms of the additional 1% of GDP spending that we were saying India still needed.
Is there any lasting impact, you see? Because, we were all very distressed, and I think it became a headline all over. I'm sure you saw the migrant crisis and going back, or do you see them coming back? Because everyone's talking about the factors that the numbers are now pre-pandemic level, but are there any lasting impact to the crisis that was there in the unorganized sector and the migrant crisis?
There hasn't been a full recovery in the labor market. If you look at employment, if you look at labor force participation, that has not fully recovered yet, and if we have another round with Omicron and so on, that could derail any such recovery. Another big area is in respect to education.
Yeah.
I think that has, children have been out of school for almost 2 years. And it's very hard. Remote learning is not easy. And, it's not practical. And it's just not even feasible for large numbers of children. The impact on learning, I think, has been substantial. And that will not automatically correct itself. It'll have to be, action will have to be taken to address it. So that is another long-lasting effect. We have to see what happens to investment. Investment has recovered, but again, it's how much more of a private sector investment will we see? It's not clear at this point. So in our projections for India, I guess one way of measuring this would be to say, 2 years from now, how does India's GDP compare to what it would have been if there wasn't the pandemic? And the numbers that we have show that there's still a substantial gap. So in that sense, there is a long-run effect.
I wanted to, there's a moral question about the whole boosters and about vaccine inequity.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, with numbers like ours, you've seen the coverage in India, would you recommend, is it morally okay to recommend boosters? I mean, or is there a dilemma there?
Well, the way I think about it is, first of all, the science should determine whether boosters are needed or not. And then it's important for governments and the private sector to ensure that there's enough production coming through so that this is not a moral dilemma. And it's possible. I'm not saying this is something that's not feasible. It's very feasible. A lot of vaccine production capacity has been set up around the world. If you can place orders in time to make sure that you get the vaccines, it's important to do that. But again, you have to follow the science on boosters. And, until recently, the sense was for the somewhat older population, 60 and above, that's where you would need the boosters. But now with Omicron, there seems to be evidence that you might need it even at younger ages.
Yeah, because even in the UK, while they've only said it for older people, I think people are just getting it.
Now in UK, they've also expanded to, I think, every adult.
Yeah, because 18 plus people are also kind of going out there to get it. Is there anything that you think that should have been done or could be done, which till now has gone amiss in the post-pandemic recovery, which some action from the government?
I think the biggest action that remains incomplete and is probably the most important thing the world needs is vaccinating the world.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a deep inequity still. Around 70% of the population in high-income countries has been vaccinated, less than 4% in low-income countries. And, you know, everybody's been working hard to try and fix it, but unfortunately, this is the number one, not just number one health policy, but number one economic policy for the world. Because that's the only way we can prevent all these new variants from coming up. That is what needs to be done on a war footing.
But isn't that a catch-22? For instance, the whole thing, now everybody's going in for boosters, so richer countries are not going to be able to share their vaccines. India had promised, but we all seem to be in that crisis right now that everyone's trying to give boosters, and it was every 6 months. So how do you fix that?
So you're right that if, you know, several nations that have a lot of vaccines already, if they start deciding to offer boosters to everybody in their adult population, then that restricts supply for now to lots of low-income countries. But again, I do think that this is a solvable problem, which is why there needs to be a global, you know, globally there has to be consensus on the fact that we can scale up production and we can get vaccine shots much more widely. So, you know, there is a lot of production capacity that has been set up in the world, and I think, you know, it's just about making sure that you're doing the math and you're saying, okay, well, if X percent goes here, this is how much we need. Make sure orders are placed. Make sure that they're delivered on time. It can be done. It's not a...
So setting aside for COVAX, which shares with... I just wanted to ask you, do you have any thoughts on, you know, there's a lot of thing about reform being pushed through and the farmers' law, you know, the farm laws... getting held up now. The farmers are claiming that it's a major victory as well. It's been a huge move. I want to know if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, with any reforms, ultimately, you have to, you know, to be able to implement it, you need the support of people in the country to be willing to do it. And so, you know, you can build consensus in very different kinds of ways. Without commenting specifically on these laws, I would just say that there is a big need for reforms in the agricultural sector in India. It's low productivity. It's not very sustainable the way agriculture works. In many places, there's free access to water and fertilizers and there's overuse of it. So, you know, important reforms are needed. And, you know, I will leave it to the experts who can figure out how to politically make these things happen.
So these were needed, but just the right way to...
No, there is absolutely, there's a need for these kinds of reforms. And there's but it's also very important to make sure that whenever you have reforms, there's always going to be a transitory period where there are people who get very badly affected by these reforms, you know. And so to make sure that they are protected it has to be a holistic package.
Did this come up in your conversation with the Prime Minister yesterday?
No, we didn't talk about this, but we talked about, you know, all the other issues of the world that we're grappling with in terms of the pandemic and with more generally reforms in general and so on.
Your predecessor at IMF, of course, had played a major role and held a major public position here in India. Do we see that? I know that you've just taken an IMF role, but I don't know if you had an offer with India. I know that you advised Kerala government in the past. But did you ever have an offer from the Indian government? And if in future you do, should we expect you to? Because it's just been a trend, right?
It's way too early. Let's see what happens. That's all I'll say.
But there was no job offer last night.
Let's not go into anything.
Okay, I just wanted to ask you, how do you see the, there's a lot of talk about post-pandemic, everyone kind of, and it's a big economic thing as well, you know, shorter weeks, much more focus on the work-life balance and paying more attention to life. Lots of people are talking about, in India we're not, lots of people are talking about the great resignation.
Yeah.
This is that whole period. I want to know just your thoughts on this.
That varies across countries. Like you said, it's not true in India. It's not true even in among advanced economies. You know, if you look at the US and Canada, which are neighbors, in Canada you don't see it. You see a lot of, you see labor force participation has gone back. You know, has come back very strongly. On the other hand, in the U.S., you don't see that. You know, there are multiple reasons for it. I think some of it is people, you know, are now much more careful about going back to jobs where there is a lot of contact with other people because it's just worried about the health consequences of it. Women's participation hasn't come back fully because of childcare reasons and the fact that women continue to be the main child caregivers, and even in the U.S. So I think that we're certainly going through a period now where people are rethinking because their lives are disrupted. They move to different places. They're working remotely. So people are indeed rethinking about what jobs do they want to do and where do they want to do this from. So we're certainly seeing that.
But do you expect people to work weeks generally to cut down, like reduce?
I suspect what is happening in the straw also at the IMF is that we're moving to so-called hybrid work models, which is, you know, previously when instead of people being present in the office 5 days of the week, there will be some days of the week when you can choose to work from home. I think people have realized that there is a, you know, you can be quite productive working from home. That at least for some time, that's going to be tried. Even post-pandemic, I think people are going to try the more hybrid form of working where people don't have to be physically present. You can do some of it is virtually done.
And my final question, it's more like a philosophy. Do you think that people who adopt or governments that adopt welfare measures, for example, we saw Jacinda Ardern come back after a major election, and the Kerala chief minister also come back, and many people kind of attributed it to their policies, welfare measures that they gave, which were popular, or how they handled COVID. Do you think that's like a shift in general global political trends, that people are looking at you know, more welfare measures or their COVID handling, all of this, how people, you know, worked in a crisis, as voting them back in?
What certainly was true during COVID was governments across the spectrum, you know, proactively started helping different parts of their of the population of the community, because this was such an exogenous shock, right? Which is, it's not as if the, you know, this was bad policies that then created trouble, but you know, this was a pandemic. So everybody immediately recognized that it's important to help people, help them with their lives and livelihoods. And I suspect that in the process, they, you know, they found new kinds of technology to transfer money to households. They found new kinds of very innovative, creative schemes of helping firms and households. So I suspect that will have a long-term effect. People will realize that there are ways to help people during in a crisis. You know, in terms of the connection to elections, I think, you know, I haven't done this analysis, but just anecdotally, there are examples where welfareism works and others when it doesn't, right? I think it's about whether you're perceived as having provided good governance and good and been an effective.
You know, you're supposed to be related to AKG as well. I don't know if that's true or if that's a... Are you?
You know, I found that out when I read about it in the press.
Okay, so then me asking you whether he influenced your economic worldview or not is perhaps...
Yeah, no, like I said, I really did not know I was related to him until I read about it.
Thank you so much for speaking to us. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this edition of On the Record, don't forget to write to us. You can contact me on Twitter at Sunetra C and on Instagram, Ms. Sunetra, to tell me what you thought of this interview and if you'd like me to interview a particular person. That's it for now. Do like and subscribe and share this podcast. I'll be back again with another edition. Till then, goodbye.
This was a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.